Good evening and welcome to The Journey Home. I'm Marcus Grodi, your host for this program. Once again, it's a great privilege to join you tonight to hear a story. Now, our guest tonight, we've got some connections, which is kind of cool. Not only is he a former Presbyterian, I was one of those, but he's also a former Presbyterian music minister. And we've got some music connections here. So I am excited to hear the story of Dr. Tim Gregson. He's the music director at the St. Paul Catholic Center at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. Well, that's really cool that you're the music director. Well, Tim, welcome to the program.
It's wonderful to be here, Marcus. Thank you.
We told you not to wear that tie, but you did. No, that's great. That's great, my friend. Very good. Well, that's awesome. You know, because this will be approaching the whole journey from a slightly different angle, I'm suspecting.
Could be.
I'm saying? Yeah. You know, because God uses it's in different ways, but the same fingerprint, you know, in people's
true.
Lives.
Yeah.
That's all true. Right. Well, let me invite you to take us way back and start us.
Yeah. So I was reared in a small town, just a small town guy in Bridgewater, Virginia, which is in the heart of the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia. And
beautiful place.
It's God's country. That's what I call it. You know that it. I think I took it for granted at the time, but yeah. I miss it and love to go back. I'm the son of an Orthodox Presbyterian pastor. I grew up hearing my dad preach. You know, every
we
Sunday.
We may have to tell the audience that OPC is not, you didn't just mean he was a good, faithful guy, but that's a, that's a denomination.
It is a denomination stemming from the United Presbyterian Church back in the 30s. J. Gresham Machen began it. And it's a very conservative, small denomination, very staunch Calvinist. Yep. And that's how I was raised. And I loved it. I loved my church. I loved hearing Dad preach every Sunday. My parents were wonderful parents, and they taught me from the very beginning to love Jesus, to have a personal relationship with Him, to follow Him. And I did. I don't remember a time when I didn't know Jesus or I didn't pray to Him. I remember I was 5 years old, I think. And for whatever reason, my parents took me to a Clyde Duncan crusade. And I told them in the car, I was in the back seat, that during the altar call, I'm going to come forward. So sure enough, at the end of the crusade, I walked forward by myself, 5 years old, and gave my life to Jesus there. It was a great childhood, very idyllic. I could see my grandparents' house from my backyard, and we could walk over all the time. And it was just, I'm very blessed to have had that childhood.
You know, and I want to make a comment here, because often I and maybe even some of my guests have been a little snarky when we talk about the Presbyterians all divided up into different denominations.
Split peas, right?
Yeah, split peas, we call them.
Yeah.
But when we say that, you know, we're, on the one hand, we're bemoaning the fact of the divisions that happen. But there's something to set on maybe the positive side, in that when I see, like, Machen, I learned Greek from his books.
Did you?
Yeah, I studied him. So anyway, but the point was, given the categories that he had, in other words, the chance of him becoming Catholic was about zero to nothing.
Sure.
You know, but what's he to do when he's in the midst of a denomination that he feels is completely losing?
Right.
What does he do? So he established, he goes faithful. And from what I know, I don't know a lot about OPC because where I live there were none, but good folk.
Yes.
Bible-believing folk, I mean, really faithful. I think Scott Hahn was connected with OPC for a while. I think he was after his ordination. But for the audience's sake, one question is, where were they sacramentally?
Right.
Did they have a monthly communion or
was it once a year? As I recall, I think I could be wrong, but I think it began quarterly and it moved to once a month, I think.
Okay. Yeah.
Something like that. And it was in my recollection, it was oh, this is going to be a much longer service, you know, because it's the full service of, you know, usually half hour at least sermon, and then communion tacked on at the end.
Yeah.
And I, at the time, I mean, I eventually learned what it meant, but at the time I didn't right. know.
Yeah.
But you know, it was Wonder Bread and yeah. and little cups of juice.
My guess is if it was real conservative Calvinist, it wouldn't have been a Zwinglian mere symbol. It would have been, but it wouldn't have been real presence, but it would have been a spiritual reality of some sort.
Yeah.
A more mysterious spiritual presence of Christ, not mere symbol and not real presence.
Yeah, I think Calvin likened it to through the elements, we are brought up into heaven and partake of Christ. But as surely as we take it, we partake of Christ. But he's not in with and under. He's not.
He's not going beyond that. He's exactly. just saying this is what Jesus said. But just leave it there.
Right.
I mean, to a certain extent, I like what he did. But that's again, given the categories that Grisham would have had, that's as far as you would
yeah.
have gone as
right.
a Protestant. And his goal was to be as biblically sound and faithful as
exactly.
possible.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And that's how I was raised. You
yeah.
know, to search the Scriptures always, like the Bereans. In fact, that was the name of our little church, Berea Presbyterian. As I got older, I went to a public elementary school, but I think almost all of my teachers went to church. They were all Christians. So, I mean, in fact, we did, you know, little musical nativity plays even in that little school. But as I aged into adolescence, I had to go to intermediate school, and my parents were concerned about other influences from my peers yeah. and everything, and they decided that they were going to send me to Eastern Mennonite High School, which is a 7th through 12th grade. Now, in the Shenandoah Valley, Mennonites are everywhere. So I was just this little, we were in this little Reformed community, but we were surrounded largely by Brethren, Mennonite, Methodist kinds of churches. And the Mennonites stemmed from Old Order to just modern day
right.
Mennonites. So, you know, I remember sitting in church and hearing the click, clop of the horse and buggies, you know, driving by our church door. This was a turning point for me because I had never encountered really other belief systems, other denominations. And I had to in the Mennonite high school.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had to take Anabaptist heritage. Well, I didn't know what Anabaptists were, mm-hmm. But I certainly did learn they're even more radical than
yeah.
In the Reformation than Calvin was. Menno Simons, Michael Sattler, people like that. And I challenged, you know, I brought this home to my dad and asked him, well, okay, well, what about this baptism thing? Why do they baptize believers? Why do they, Anabaptist means rebaptism. Why, right. why did they feel like they had to rebaptize after leaving the Catholic Church? And I learned he gave me scriptures like from the Old Testament, how baptism replaces circumcision. Yeah. And it's all about the covenant. You know, you're initiated into the covenant community. It doesn't save you necessarily, but you know that those are the kinds of things that I was learning, and I would take it back to school, and I would challenge my professors, you know, and everything. And but it was all in, you know, it was fun. In fact, when I graduated from Eastern Mennonite High School, they awarded me the Senior Challenge Award. I think because I was a troublemaker, I kept saying, well, you know, I posted things on the bulletin board, like, well, this is what Calvin would say, kind of a thing, and what do we do here? So I was beginning to see the spectrum of Protestantism.
You know, I was thinking that, and there may be a Methodist, a Mennonite, a Calvinist watching, mm-hmm. but it seems to me that the simplest way, because I'm thinking there's some Catholics that don't get all this.
Sure, yeah.
They know they don't all the stuff that we argued about. But it almost has to do with how one understands grace. Because the more conservative Calvinist you are, it's everything is grace. which would therefore argue for infant baptism, because it has nothing to do with you. It's sure. only grace. Mm-hmm. But on the other side, if grace has to do with how God enables us to be holy, now we're in the ranks of the Anabaptists. In other words, that's why baptism is a choice you make, because grace has drawn you to God and you've responded.
Right, right.
You know, there's this difference. It's how you understand grace.
Exactly.
They both believe in grace, but sure. it's just a different understanding of it.
Yeah, that's right. The great thing about the Mennonites is they can sing. That's okay. So, you know, we in my congregation, we would sing just the melody. It was all in unison. But I remember the first time I walked into our chapel when I was in seventh grade, and the music director got up and he had a little tuning fork and he hit it on his knee and listened to it. And from there, he found the pitches for whatever hymn that we were going to sing. And mind you, this is 7th through 12th grade kids, right? He gave them the pitches, and we started singing. No piano, no instrument whatsoever, and it was four-part harmony, and it blew me away. I had never heard anything like that in my life. And I was hooked. I fell in love with choral singing. I didn't know that I had a talent in it until later, and realized my music director thinks I can sing well, and I thought, this is what I want to do. I want to go into music, and I want to be what my choir director was, Jay Hartzler, directing choirs for Jesus, basically to worship Him. So I graduated and went to Covenant College, which is it's another denomination, but it was also Presbyterian,
right.
or is also Presbyterian. Mm-hmm. While I was there, I earned a Bachelor of Music in Vocal Performance, and I was I was pretty successful. I did well in the competitions and singing there at college. But while I was there, I started singing in an Episcopal church choir. And I had never experienced, high church liturgy before. I didn't know what that was like. I had never read the Book of Common Prayer before. And, Marcus, I fell in love with that. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful that it elevated my heart to God. And it was good worship there. I think it was St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And I took communion every Sunday, and just soaked in the beauty, the richness. Mm-hmm. They would sometimes have incense, and they would sometimes sing, like we sang Schubert's Mass in G one time, just as part of the ordinary of the Mass, which the Episcopals use. And so this combination of Mennonite, Presbyterian, Episcopalian, combined with the music that kind of suffused it all, was moving me and changing me. And
our guest is Dr. Tim Gregson. Yeah, it's fascinating. I'm kind of surprised that your little OPC church only sang one pitch, because usually my experience was even us Presbyterians used to sing it in four-part harmony if the book gave it. It's a problem with our Catholic hymnals. Sometimes you don't need to have the...
Right.
You know, that's
our hymnal gave it, but most of it was just in unison.
Yeah, but you also went to the Mennonite. I don't know what their hymns are, but then you went to the British hymns.
Yes,
the Isaac Watts and all that richness. That's there. There was one of our convert priests wrote a book on the 200 greatest hymns.
Yeah,
he's a convert to the church. Most of those are Anglican. Cracks me up.
Really?
Yeah. Because they are great hymn writers. And that's what you were discovering on top of that. Plus, now you're saying also, it wasn't just the music itself, it was the entire high liturgy.
Yeah, yeah. I loved it. I just loved it. Mm-hmm. But again, I did well. And by the time I was a senior, I had to decide what I was going to do. What did I want to do? Did I want to teach? Did I want to try to sing professionally?
Had you ever talked to your dad about this music stuff? I mean, why don't we do this back at the Did that ever come up?
I remember talking to him about it, because they would come to visit sometimes, and they would come to St. Paul's, and
yeah.
He actually did not go to when he was being taught, trained. He went to Reformed Episcopal Seminary instead of Westminster.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So he understood, you know, the liturgy. He understood my attraction.
Okay.
So. But I did decide, you know, what I was going to do. And I kept coming back to the church. I kept coming back to, I want to do music in church and help church music be good, as good as I can make it.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew of a seminary called the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. And they had a separate, it was almost a conservatory of church music and worship. It's called the School of Church Music and Worship. And they had, you know, great musician teachers there. But it was great because I could get theology and I could get music, and it was really all top notch. Now, Baptist, right? So that it was interesting. I would think that they would call themselves, at least a lot of the professors there, would call themselves Reformed, but in a Baptist sense.
Yeah.
So they did do believer's baptism. You know, they didn't hold to Calvin's covenant theology necessarily, but they were, you know, it wasn't entirely different from my training, my upbringing, but it was different. But it was, you know, here I am, I'm getting all these different denominations in my life, but I kept coming back to liturgy. And I had to find a job. And I saw on the job board that there was a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod looking for a choir master organist. So I, you know, I contacted them, and I went and talked with him, and they hired me. And again, it was different. It was new, but I loved it. And the Lutherans, I had never really studied Luther, but I wanted to, you know, I wanted to soak in what he had to say. And, I was very attracted. In fact, at this point in my life, I was considering possibly becoming Lutheran, because I enjoyed the church so much, and I enjoyed the people, and I thought, you know, I was attracted to Lutheran theology. But in the end, I was not convinced that it was true. And he had some inconsistencies that kind of bothered me, that I realized, you know, Lutherans try to parse through and create their own systematic theology.
But I mean, the founder of the Anglican Church had some inconsistencies too.
Yeah.
But, well, you don't know to go there, but even as you're going into the Lutheran churches, kind of like in the Presbyterian churches, it depends on which Lutheran church you landed with, whether it's going to be high mass, Mass, or whether it's going to be, you know, a more contemporary. So did you have a more of a high mass experience?
It was lower.
Gotcha. But still, the liturgy of the Lutheran church is almost like the Novus Ordo. I
mean, it is. It is. It was good. And again, I did well in seminary, but I was convinced that Luther, I mean, I talked with my dad about it a lot. And you know, I came away saying, this is not, I don't believe this enough to be true to convert to Lutheranism. But Catholic Church was not even on my mind, right? I mean, I would not say that I was raised anti-Catholic, but certainly not good. I mean, the Catholic Church was not a good place to be. My dad told me that he thought if there were Christians in the Catholic Church, that it was in spite of the Catholic Church, not because of it. And I held that to be
common view,
be true. You know, I thought it was a step away from paganism, worshiping bread and praying to saints as though they were like different Greek gods, kind of a thing. You know, that was kind of my outlook. So it wasn't even part of it, part of my thinking. But I got a job at First Presbyterian Church in Aurora, Illinois, after seminary. And that was my first full-time music ministry job. And, you know, like most church jobs, you walk in and you don't know really what you're getting into.
Now, would this have been a UP?
That's PCUSA? Part of the story. It's PCUSA. Right. And I was always told that's as bad as Catholics, right? You know, that's because they're, you know, liberal theology and, but this was not a liberal church. In fact, I would say that I came to realize after being there for a couple years, most of these people are Baptists. they just believe in the Baptist common non-denominational kind of thing. They were not really formed in Reformed theology. But the PCUSA thing was still a problem, and that was kind of on the horizon when I became the music director there. And in fact, it came to a head within 2 or 3 years, and they were talking a lot about leaving PCUSA. Right. And then it's, of course, you know, where should we go? Should we become independent? Should we join OPC, ARP, EPC, you know, yeah. Cumberland? What should we do? And it was landed on going Evangelical Presbyterian, the EPC church. Now, something at this point was beginning to stick in my craw. Now, I thought it was a good idea to leave the PCUSA. Yeah. I knew that a lot of things that were happening there were not biblical, were not good in the leadership and so forth. But here we are splitting again. Hmm. Now, at this point, you know, I have this mosaic background. I have Orthodox Presbyterian. I have Presbyterian Church in America. Why they're not together, I never could tell. I still don't know. I had Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. I had Baptist. I had Mennonite. And had Episcopalian. All of these things. Mm-hmm. And the Protestant spectrum was before my eyes, and here we are splitting again. Yeah. I had no answer for that. And I thought it was a good thing, but it was an issue. It was just an issue in the back of my head. The other problem at First Presbyterian Church in Aurora was that there were very different worship services. Now, worship wars. Have you heard of the worship wars? Boy, was it raging at First Pres. We essentially had two congregations. On the one hand, we had traditional people who wanted to sing strictly hymns. Well, hymns and Bill Gaither. And excuse me. On the other side was, I mean, it was just straight out of the radio, rock and roll. Christian rock, full band and everything. And this was a decision that the elders had made, I don't know, in the 90s, I think. So I came in and they didn't like each other. And I had to deal with this, and it was kind of laid in my lap to deal with. And I tried different things with, you know, music and trying to incorporate some of both, you know, try to do a blended thing, you know, it's trying to bring people together.
I'm sorry.
That's right. And it wasn't working. It wasn't working. And I realized at some point, well, actually, I reached my limit, and I sat down at my desk one day, put my head in my hands, and I was just like, Lord, show me truth. Show me truth. And in my head, I was thinking, show me truth about what's the proper worship, what's the proper music to use in your worship. But God heard that prayer. And I realized soon after that the issue was not so much the music that people preferred. The issue was, what is worship? What are we supposed to do in worship? What does God require of us in worship? And nobody really knew that in the church, including me. I was not equipped to answer that question.
You know, Tim, I don't know if I should talk about this on the program, but as I'm hearing you talk about that, it's so reminiscent to me, because I was a pastor of a PCUSA church, just like the one you were pastor
really?
Of. Oh, yeah. But I was a conservative evangelical in that denomination, and dealing with the worship wars in my own church.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you're talking about, because we had one worship that was traditional, and then we had another. And since I was a musician, I was helping out what we'd do. Here we'd be singing Isaac Watts, Tim's, and here's we'd be singing the Gaither stuff at different worships, and who wanted what. And you'd have a large church. My last church had 2,000 members. And so they're back and forth between these different worship things. And depending on what music person you have come in, all of a sudden we have a different battle going on.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the music person at the church has been there for decades. And
yes,
so
yes.
She or he runs the church.
Yeah.
You know, at one church I pastored, the music leader was the head of the 4-H band for Ohio.
Wow.
You know, so, you know what I'm saying? So the problem with the PCUSA is that the local church has the total authority to decide what. There's no denominational guidance.
That's right.
Though there was a time when they were putting together liturgical books that they were trying to get the local churches to do. And this might have been before you were born, because I think I was a pastor before you were born. but anyways, we would throw those out because that sounded too Catholic.
Yeah, really.
So I know exactly the battle. Where do you go?
Right.
Where do you go? And sometimes no matter what you do, you're going to lose, because there's going to be somebody that's going to be angry with not charismatic enough, or it's not traditional enough, or we shouldn't have these instruments, or we got too many instruments, or drums. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know, and there you are in the midst of it with, and then it depends on whether your pastor's, what side he's going to be on.
That's right. I had a great pastor, because he came from a tradition that had good music, but he also liked the band stuff as well. So, I mean, he was very helpful and worked yeah. with me. My saving grace was that I got married, honestly.
Why don't we save that for after the break?
Yeah,
okay. Let's take a break now.
Sure.
Our guest is Dr. Tim Gregson. We'll come back in just a moment and find out more about his journey. See you in a bit. Welcome back to The Journey Home. I'm Marcus Grody, your host, and our guest is Dr. Tim Gregson. And before we jump into the story, just really quickly, I want to remind you of the Coming Home Network's website, chnetwork.org. If you go to that, you'll find out all kinds of other conversion stories like Tim's and other ways that you can get connected, especially if you're on the journey to the church. We'd love to stand beside you and help you discern God's call for you in your life. So, at chnetwork.org. All right, Tim. So you just said that you the savior of your life
is my wife Melissa. No, I mean it's Jesus Christ. But I met my wife Melissa very early on when I came to First Press. She had grown up in the church there, and I like to tell people it was part of my contract that I marry one of the daughters of the church. But no, it was. If I would not have been able to deal with all the stuff that I had to deal with at First Press if it weren't for her and her support. So to this day, I'm very blessed with my wife. And she stood by me and supported me the whole time, even at this point that I'm about to tell you. I told you that I was not equipped to handle this worship question. My background was music, and you know, but while I believed in Presbyterian understanding of worship, you know, the sermon, the word is the center of the service. I didn't know how to teach that, and I didn't know what the biblical fundamentals were regarding that. So I happen to know of a man named Robert Weber, Bob Weber. He was a professor at Wheaton nearby, and he had started a school about 10 years before this point in my journey called the Institute for Worship Studies. And it was an accredited institution where you can go and you can either earn a master's of worship studies or a doctor of worship studies. I already had a master of church music, so I enrolled. And it was a kind of a, it worked with people like me that had full-time jobs. So you had 2 weeks during the year of intensive study in Jacksonville, Florida. And then the rest of the period was you working on your own and with others online. And that was, you know, I learned the biblical fundamentals of worship and everything. The great thing about Bob Weber, though, was that his whole intent was to renew worship in the Protestant world by going back to the fathers. Hippolytus, Cyril of Jerusalem, you know, all of these people who wrote on worship and wrote on the importance of the sacraments. And I, you know, I ate that stuff up, and I loved his writing. I had encountered it before this. I didn't know he'd started a school, but I remember kneeling in our church sanctuary, wondering if I should do this. And my answer was yes, and Melissa totally supported me in it, and so I did it. And it was about a 3-year program, and I was supposed to come back with my knowledge, because it's an applied degree, right? So I come back to my church and I try to teach, try to train, try to do different projects to help them through this process of learning about worship and unifying around it, around Jesus in worship rather than around music, which I came to realize is sacramentalized in the Protestant world. It's as though they're saying, this music, this is where I encounter God. You know, the preaching is great. You know, I can learn how to live, learn how to behave morally, but I encounter God in the music. Which sounds familiar, you know? That's what sacraments used to be for, right? This is where we encounter God in the preaching and in the sacraments. It was a great education. And then came the time when my daughter, Mina, was to be born. And this was just before my 801 class, the final doctoral thesis class. And we did not think that we were ever going to get pregnant. We didn't think it was going to happen. And nobody really knew why. And suddenly, it happened. And you and I both know. When you come to the realization that you're going to be a father, it changes your perspective on the world. And I was thinking, okay, how should I raise her? I want to instill the faith in her the way my parents instilled the faith in me, but I'm looking at my church and I'm looking at the way people behave and the wars that were going on. Now, not everybody was bad, but you know what I mean. And I look at our youth group, and there's this dearth of understanding that I was developing about the history, the ancient faith of our ancient faith, and the things that aren't ever talked about anymore, like the sacraments and the liturgy and so forth. And do I want to send her to our church youth group where, I mean, I don't mean any offense, but, you know, it was rather gimmicky, you know, take your sin, write it on a piece of paper, and nail it to the cross. You know, that kind of a shallow faith kind of a thing. So that was, you know, that was a new struggle in my head. And then comes the 801 class, and I decide I'm going to do my thesis on the Eucharist. What is the Eucharist? You know, what should we believe about the Eucharist? And I was going to apply it to our congregation because we celebrated the Eucharist. We celebrated communion, the Lord's Supper, in 2 different ways. One, people gathered around in groups and like huddles, and they passed the bread around, and they would intinction, right? They would dip it in the cup. And the other was the traditional Presbyterian. You pass the plate, and you pass the tiny juice cups. So I thought, well, that's one thing I can address with our with our congregation. So that was my goal. And the first book I opened up as I sat down to study for my thesis was Thomas Howard's Evangelical Is Not Enough. Oh my goodness. That's when the scales dropped. I was knocked off my proverbial horse, if you will. He started talking about sola scriptura in that, and all of my background suddenly became crystal clear. The Episcopalian liturgy, you know, the Mennonite sense of community and the music, the Presbyterian, all of these things. It's like those magic pictures that you look at, and it just looks like a bunch of design. And then, you know, the 3D image pops out. And I started shaking in my chair because I couldn't argue with what Tom Howard was saying. And the ground felt like it was crumbling underneath me, and I didn't know what to do. Still, I'd not even thought about being Catholic. And I think at the time that he wrote that, he was Episcopalian.
Yeah, for the audience, which is a fine book, and I recommend every book by Tom Howard, God rest his soul. He wrote that when he had gone from evangelicalism to high church Anglican.
Right.
That's where he was arguing.
Right.
But he hit the trajectory there, and eventually, when the book was republished, he had become Catholic. That was the book that got my wife on her journey too.
Is it really?
Oh yeah.
Is it really?
Yeah, about the prayer. Remember his chapter on liturgical prayer versus spontaneous prayer?
Yeah, right. It was just it was such a brilliant book, and I love his books. But then, so I was, you know, I was in a moment of crisis. It really, really was, because what he was saying was true. And there was no denying what he says in that book. But, you know, what does that mean? What do I do? I still have to write this. You know, I have to write, you know, the Eucharist. And I did. I mean, I kept studying and studying and studying, but the scales had fallen. And I was being kind of drawn slowly to Catholic Church. I had done a class on baptism the previous year, and there was a gentleman in that class that I knew. His name was Jim Adrian, and he always asked the greatest questions, you know, the questions that made me think the most. Huh. And so one time I asked him if he could get together for coffee or something. I just wanted to talk to him about these kinds of things. He's Catholic, Marcus. I didn't know that he was Catholic. And, you know, it turns out he came to First Press with his wife, who was Presbyterian, but he always went to the 8:30 Mass before he came to First Press. I didn't know that he was Catholic. And he knew his stuff. And we hit it off right away. I mean, he was in every way a godsend, because I had all these questions, and I could turn to him. And he was always there. And I think from that point on, we had lunch at least once a week. And I would ask him, you know, Mary, saints, what does all of this stuff mean? And he was able to answer in an engaging way, you know, that I could bounce stuff off of him. Well, okay, but what about this, you know? And it was incredible that God placed him in my life at that time. And here I was working on this project on the Eucharist, and I was going to teach a class, 6-part class on it. I developed, you know, a whole curriculum for it, and I started teaching it, and I didn't know actually where I sat.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know that I should be Calvinist anymore, at least in my sacramentality. I started questioning, like, why am I loyal to Calvin? Is it because he's really smart? He didn't have any you know, he was not ordained, right? I mean, so where does his authority come from? Is it because he was able to divine the scriptures rightly and nobody else was? You know, these are the questions that I kept coming up with. When I taught that class, I got to the point where, you know, I was going to describe, here's what the Catholics believe about, you know, transubstantiation, here's what Calvin believed, here's what Luther believed, here's what Zwingli believed. And when I taught the transubstantiation, I didn't say, this is Catholic, this is Calvin, this is Lutheran. I kind of said, here's what one group believes, here's what another group believes, here's what another group believes. But when I got to what the Catholics believe, I described what transubstantiation is, you know, the substance is what changes, you know, into the reality of the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Christ. And people were like, oh, that's what it means. Like they thought that I was describing what happens in communion in their church. I said, no, guys, this is what Catholics believe. They were like, okay, you know, it was kind of funny, but I it was difficult because I couldn't, you know, I would say, here's what our church believes. I didn't say, this is what I believe, because I didn't know anymore. So it was a trying time, but I still had my parents to deal with.
I was going to wonder, how's your whole family?
Well, I hadn't told them yet, and I knew that I had to. I was going to say, I also became a member of the Coming Home Network, and I was put in touch with Ken Howell. And today, even to this day, we're very good friends.
Yeah.
He helped me a lot. My first question...
Well, you're teaching at where he went to school.
What's that? Say
he
that.
Got his first PhD at Indiana.
Did he? Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
So he comes to visit from time to time. But anyway, I was also put in touch with Ken Hensley. In fact, I had listened to his CDs on Sola Scriptura, which knocked my socks off. I mean, those were so good. I highly recommend getting his material, because he's a very good teacher. He does a very good job.
Yeah.
We talked on the phone a couple of times. So it was, the Lord was kind of developing this cloud of earthly witnesses for me, so that I could go to them to ask them questions. Matt Leonard was on your show. I think it was the first time he was on your show. And I contacted him afterwards, and he got back to me immediately and said, contact this priest, Father Mark Mannion. So I did, and sat down with him a couple times. I think he's an Opus Dei priest. And one time we were sitting in McDonald's, and he sat back and he was like, so do you want me to call Scott Hahn? I was like, do you know who Scott Hahn is? He was like, yeah, sure. So right there, calls up Scott Hahn right there in McDonald's. Scott didn't pick up. He was on vacation. But the following Sunday, I get a call from Scott Hahn, and we talk for a while. Again, you know, he's answering these theological questions, and it was incredible. Like the people that the Lord allowed me to meet along the way, none of them, by the way, tried to force anything or convince me of anything. They were just there to answer questions. I eventually did graduate with a doctor of worship studies. I got my thesis done, and by then we had another child, and things were progressing. But I had to talk to Melissa, and I had to talk to my parents.
Yeah.
And I did. I wrote an email, in fact, to Melissa, just to get things on a page, basically, just for my own sake, really. And asked her. I said, I need you to come with me, because I'm scared, and this could have huge ramifications. So we talked, and she agreed, and we started listening to like Lighthouse Catholic Media CDs and debates and so forth when we were traveling. And at first she was like, I don't really want anything to do with Catholicism. But eventually she started to understand, and all of our talks, she came alongside me, and we journeyed it together. The other thing with my parents, I told them I was struggling with Sola Scriptura as a doctrine, didn't understand how that could work when everybody approaches the Bible and comes to different conclusions, mm-hmm. In the Protestant spectrum. And I wrote them a very long letter regarding it and said that this is what the Catholics teach regarding Sola Scriptura and how it doesn't really work. You need a magisterium. You need tradition.
Yeah.
So I gave that to them. Didn't hear back really for a while. I talked to them a couple times. My dad thought there was logical fallacies, and I asked him to show me where. But I didn't hear back really about it. And I think they were very concerned, with good reason.
Yeah.
So then we decided to enroll in RCIA. And we did not think that we were going to join. We thought, let's do RCIA, just, we don't have to join at the end. Let's kind of build these blocks mm-hmm. together, you and me, Melissa and me. And we went about 20 miles away, so no yep. one would know who we were. It's actually where Jim Adrian went anyway, the parish there. And we would learn things, and then on the way home, we would discuss them. And at first, she was like, oh, I don't believe that. But then, again, slowly, it's how the Holy Spirit works. And there were all these times when I was like, oh, this is too hard, I can't do this. Because it means too much, you know, it would upend yeah. our lives. It was too hard. But then it was like the tide rolling in and out. It keeps coming farther and farther. And that's kind of how my thinking and emotional processes were. So we went through RCIA. We couldn't even have joined that time if we wanted to, because Nicholas was born on Holy Saturday evening. So we couldn't have joined the church at the Easter Vigil. And I was emotionally unready. I just wasn't ready. I was pretty convinced intellectually, but my heart, and I was scared. I was scared of...
I mean, at this time, you're still music director at the Presbytery Church.
I'm still a music director, directing orchestras, directing choirs, you know, doing my yeah. thing. And things were getting better as far as the congregation went anyway. It was much better than it had been. So then came the day that we told my parents. It was like a year after I had given them the Sola Scriptura letter, that we thought the Lord was leading us to the Catholic Church. My dad's first response was, you can't let your mother, where your mother and I are, influence where you are. Mm-hmm. However, you know, I think you're very wrong, and there's a lot of issues in the Catholic Church that I don't think you know about. You know, moms didn't say too much. They were very upset. And I had to take them to the airport, and it was a dark day. It was rainy, and took them to the airport. It was a kind of quiet van ride. And on the way back, I thought I was done. I was like, I just broke my parents' hearts. I don't want to do that. I can't do that. And I told God, why is this, why am I going through this? And why is it so hard in your church to find what your church is? And why is it so hard when everybody has a different opinion? It should not be this way. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to stick with being a Presbyterian. That day, I was supposed to meet Jim Adrian at Marmion Abbey in North Aurora, Illinois, Benedictine Abbey. We met there often. And I went in. As I was driving into the parking lot, these storm clouds rolled in. And I don't think you've seen it, but the Marmion Abbey, the architecture is this, looks like a great bow of a ship, mm-hmm. like this. And I walked in the doors. And no sooner did I walk in the doors than it just downpoured. Thunder and lightning, you know. And I went into the pew and sat down. And the gospel reading that day was, Matthew 10:34, do not think that I have come to bring peace on earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword to separate man from his father, daughter-in-law from her mother-in-law. He who does not love me is not worthy of me. He who does not take up his cross daily and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. That was the gospel of the day. And I knew. Now, it was about 3 months later, I decided it's time. And so the following Easter Vigil, we joined the Catholic Church.
What happened then? I mean, about your calling and...
I was given 3 months to find a new job, which was, you know, they could have fired me on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
I had to tell the congregation, I had to tell the Board of Elders. I found a job in Wisconsin Rapids as a choir director for middle school, high school, Go Royals, Assumption Catholic Schools there. But that wasn't for me. That was a very difficult year. Local parish opened up their rectory and welcomed us in. So we stayed in a rectory next to a Marian grotto where my kids could play while I was teaching at school. It was very much like Mary and Joseph and the manger. It was like they just opened up this place that wasn't meant for a family of five, but they opened it up for us, and we were taken care of. And then I looked for a music ministry job, because that's really where my heart is, what I love to do. And this job opened up in Bloomington at the Newman Center there, and I can work with students and parishioners, and it's been a great experience. It has not been easy to do the transition, and you know, you learn different things about Catholic culture and that I didn't know. But
even Paul, when he got knocked off a horse, he went away to Tarsus for about 10 years, right? Before he came back and really jumped into ministry, it took a while. He had to leave. Well, yeah, I need to go get a graduate studies, you know, before I come back. It takes a while. I mean, to jump in right out of that Presbyterian church into that little parish is a different whole world.
It is a different world. Different world.
And it's also hard when you have to tell your family, because you think yourself how much data you had to have first work of grace for you and your wife to come to it.
Right.
Well, then you go to tell someone who hasn't had any of that.
I know.
What can we expect?
I totally understand, you know, how if they thought, if the Catholic Church was what they think it is, then they were right. They're right to be upset, you know. I had since learned differently. So, and I could be mistaken, but I'm willing. I'm always willing to search for truth, no matter what. My goal is to take up my cross and follow.
Yeah. Well, I would say that one of the blessings, though, for you is that your wife did come with you. That's often the biggest hurdle for
exactly. both. Exactly. I know what Scott and Kimberly Hahn went through. The Lord showed such grace to us. It's wonderful. Yeah.
Well, you know, I would love to take the time, Tim, to now that we got you in the church, to you evaluate for all the people at home, you know, good Catholic music, what kind of music ought to be in worship, polyphony versus chant versus all that. But we only got 30 seconds left. So, my friend, we're going to have you back sometime.
I would love to, Marcus. Thank you so
much. It was great. It was great to have you here. And I look forward to... you meet my son sometime.
I would love to meet him.
They're both very much in music, especially my son Peter, who was once a music director at a Newman Center up at Bowling Green.
Yeah, so. That's great.
Well, thank you for sharing your story with us, all right?
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, Tim. And thank you for joining us on this episode of the Journey Home. Boy, I pray that Tim's journey is an encouragement to you. Pray for him and his extended family. We're still all on the journey, right?
Yeah.
So thank you all. And once again, let me remind you of going to the website, chnetwork.org, and you can find out more about Tim as well as other conversion stories. So God bless you. Look forward to seeing you again next week.